Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. How a Chicago author says napping, resting, and taking a break can all be tools used to resist oppressive systems.
Daly's Midnight Caper became a textbook example of mayoral clout.
How Meg's Field became a public park.
I loved this show even before I was on it.
Generations of kids grew up with her, actress Sonia Manzano, when playing Maria on Sesame Street and more.
Because we are the steppers capital of the world.
And we explore the culture of the popular Chicago dance style known as steppin'. And we kick things off right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Taking a stand against capitalism by taking a nap. That's the message of the woman known as the Nap Bishop. Chicago native Tricia Hersey founded the Nap Ministry in 2016, advocating that rest is about more than just refueling for the next day's work, but for resistance. The activist, artist, and author of two books is back in her hometown to spread the word this Juneteenth. Joining us now is the Nap Bishop herself, Tricia Hersey. Honored to have you here because I know you are protective of your time.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. So your first of four tenets of the Nap Ministry is that rest is a form of resistance because it disrupts and pushes back against capitalism and white supremacy.
Yes.
Oof.
So
that's
it's a mouthful.
That is a lot.
It's a lot in there.
Break that down for us, please.
Yeah, you know, I think when I first started the work, people were like, what does naps have to do with white supremacy? What does naps and our labor and our lack of rest and our sleep deprivation have to do with capitalism? So it's hoping to connect the dots by looking at it from a historical examination of what capitalism is, where it was founded. It was founded on plantations, on the backs of enslaved Africans. And so the same engine that drove automating the body, the commodification of black bodies, working 20 hours, the agricultural chattel slavery, is the same engine that is driving capitalism today that has people working two, three, four jobs, profit over people, they still can't pay rent. And so all of these things about how we see ourselves, our bodies, what our bodies hold and what our bodies are here to do around the idea of labor really is about that first tenet. People really are like, I don't understand why I'm so exhausted. I'm like, you're moving at a pace that's unsustainable. Capitalism demands this time, this output that is really, truly unsustainable.
Exhausted and not always necessarily feeling like they're getting ahead, because isn't that sort of like, you know, an American mantra is that, you know, work hard and you can achieve it all.
Yes, that is the one of the many lies we've been told. So one of the many things that have been kind of socializing us to believe that we can work our way to freedom, that we can work our way into the greatness of everything. People who are poor work the most of everyone. So if that really was the full scale of it, it would be a different view. I know people like my father, I talk about in my first book, who worked himself into an early grave. I think about people, two, three jobs. I just read an article yesterday. Most people, if you're working $80,000 a year, you still can't afford to live anywhere in the United States. It was just an article out yesterday. So this idea of pushing and going and thinking that your worth is tied to how much that you can get done. So it's really a full examination. It's an awareness. It's an opening. It's a connecting of the dots so that people really understand what is really happening to us with sleep deprivation and with our idea of who we are.
And this whole hustle and grind culture, though, it's not just unique to black Americans, right? White Americans can fall victim to this as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, this work is a global work. It's really work that is human rights work. It's looking at the idea of who we are, what we are, and then seeing ourselves as full divine humans, no matter how many jobs we work, no matter how many things we accomplish, no matter how much money we make. It's pulling the veil over our eyes so that we can really see ourselves for the true nature of who we are. everyone is suffering under the violence and terror of capitalism and white supremacy. Even white people themselves are suffering deeply from the spiritual deficit that comes from white supremacy ideology, capitalism pushing the profit over people, do anything to make money. And so those things are really what is really driving the work. Mm-hmm.
So in your first book, Rest is Resistance, a manifesto, you mentioned, you know, all the commonly used sayings that celebrate, you know, the hustle and grind culture, thinking of the early bird gets the worm, right? Get up early and go to work. I'll sleep when I'm dead. And in black households, you know, a lot of people, you know, we're used to hearing you have to work twice as hard to get just as far or half as far.
I was told that,
Weren't we all, right? And sometimes by our teachers as well. So how do we begin to sort of step away from what we have been conditioned to do without fear of missing out on opportunities or being deemed, God forbid, lazy or, you know, not a go-getter?
I think that's such an important question. I get this question so many times. Everyone wants to know, like, I love what you're saying, but how? I have to work. And it's really, that's really the point of it all. I'm really asking us to really just begin to see clearly what is happening. I don't believe that we can stop working at any time. I don't believe me as a black woman could ever not be laying around leisurely all the time. Like, I have bills the same way everyone else does. We all are living in a system that demands that we have output. What I'm asking people is that they begin to see themselves as not simply just on earth to work, that their labor is not attached to who they are and how the worth of who they are. You know, this culture really teaches us to hate ourselves, to not see worth of who we are just simply by being alive, that we have to be able to connect the dots between I have these accomplishments, I have this much in the bank, I've done these many things, and now I'm okay, now I'm beautiful, now I'm enough. And I'm really asking people to say that you are enough right now, that you can begin to slow down, see yourself as human, that you can resist the lie that you are a machine, that you can work 20 hours, 24 hours, that you need to hustle, that you need to monetize every single hobby in your life, that you can't have leisure, that there isn't space for you to breathe and to be, that you can't connect. And so this is really healing work for us to begin to uplift what needs to be healed. What are the things that we've been told that have caused us to not see ourselves as whole humans?
You mentioned that rest isn't just napping, even though you're the nap bishop. But you talk about your grandmother especially and how that woman, she got her rest in, right? It wasn't always a nap. But talk about other ways that people can rest.
In my book, I talk about the idea of reimagining rest, like this idea that we're in this culture, in a culture that demands so much from us, that in a culture that's technologically, we're moving, we're going, that we're going to have to reimagine what resting is. It can't just be us going away, closing the door, telling our children to leave us alone, putting ourselves under a blanket and never coming out and not being in a community with each other. We're really going to have to begin to reimagine resting as being something simply that slows you down enough that you can connect your mind and body, a slow walk, yoga, meditation, prayer.
And we're looking at some pictures of some of the events that you've done as well.
Meditating, daydreaming. Daydreaming is a big one. I'm really deep on the idea of daydreaming and just having moments to just be. I think about my mother, Jean, every morning taking her 15 minutes to put her Jergens lotion on. You know, like even not rushing out the house, not answering a phone call immediately. There are infinite ways to slow down, to rest, to connect, to detox from social media, to feel and be truly who we are outside of just labor, outside of just getting things done.
And you also talk about the importance of rest so that you can dream, because when you're busy all the time, there's no time for your brain to just roam freely.
No time at all.
What's the benefit of dreaming?
Dreaming is really, we really want to get into the science. The neuroscience of sleep tells us when we sleep for more than 6 hours, more than 8 hours, our brain allows us to imagine, to heal. There are moments where we can like reboost our memory. People who are creative really need time to just sit and dream and imagine. And these have been taken from us because we've been told it's lazy, you're wasting time, stop daydreaming. But dreaming itself, when we're in a full dream cycle, does so much for our organs, for our mental health. And with the mental health crisis that is happening now in our culture, slowing down and dreaming and resting and daydreaming really is going to be the key to so many things that are around our wellness.
All right. Sweet dreams. Trisha Hersey, thank you so much
for
joining us.
It's
been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Up next, the inside story on a memorable Chicago transformation. Stay with us. Saturday marks the official beginning of summer, and Chicago has a magnificent park that you may not know about. It's on Northerly Island between the old McCormick Place and Soldier Field. It used to be an airport. So what happened? Our Eunice Alpasan has the story in our latest edition of WTTW News Explains.
We all know O'Hare and Midway, but along the lakefront near Soldier Field and the Adler Planetarium is a little strip of land that was once home to a small airport called Meigs Field. That was until one March morning, a little over 20 years ago, when the city awoke to find Mayor Richard M. Daley had the airport bulldozed in the middle of the night. This audacious covert bulldozing operation was the conclusion to a years-long political battle to turn the airport into what it is now, Northerly Island Park. So how is this even possible? First, let's back up. By the mid-20th century, Meigs Field was the busiest single runway airport in the country. It was primarily used by politicians and business elites to jet in and out of downtown. But Mayor Richard M. Daley had other plans for the land. The man-made peninsula that Meigs Field sat on was owned by the Chicago Park District. And for years, some Chicagoans, Daley included, argued the lakefront land should instead be used as a park open to all residents. But a series of political deals and pushback from aviation and business advocates kept the airport open. So Daley hatched a plan. By cover of night in March 2003, the mayor's demolition crew arrived at the airport and carved giant X's into the runway, rendering it unusable. And all of this was done without telling the city council, the state, or the Federal Aviation Administration. The surprise move left several planes stranded. Daley defended the stunt as a necessary post-9/11 security measure to prevent planes from flying near downtown Chicago. But critics and pundits say the mayor was merely dodging a prolonged and expensive legal battle with various groups fighting to keep the airport open. No matter the purpose of the plot, Chicago had to pay the FAA a $33,000 fine and an additional $1 million to repay grant funding. Daley's Midnight Caper became a textbook example of mayoral clout, and Meigs Field became Northerly Island Park, home to an outdoor concert venue and an urban nature sanctuary.
And a great place to visit in the summer. You can watch our whole series of explainers on our website. Everything from how the city's grid system works to how Chicago's pension debt is so high. Just go to WTTW.com/explains. Up next, Sesame Street's Maria. Stay with us. Sunny day sweeping the clouds away. That's how Sonia Manzano spent her career for more than four decades. The actress hung out with Big Bird, Oscar the Grouch, and the whole gang while playing Maria on the beloved program Sesame Street. Manzano was recently in Chicago, where she spoke with Chicago Commons and supporters about the importance of early childhood education. We sat down with her while she was in town and took a trip down memory lane.
How did you get to Sesame Street?
It was such a wild time. It was the late 60s. America was a different place. It was an idealistic place. It was the civil rights movement, and Joan Ganz Cooney had this brilliant idea of using television to reach underserved children. I remember her on a talk show. She said, the people who run the world can read, therefore these children have to know how to read. So it was an exciting time, and I simply got cast. I think the most important things happen to you when you're not paying that much attention. I was in a Broadway show. I didn't realize it was gonna go on and on for so many years.
What was the importance of your role on Sesame Street at the time? Because there was not a lot of Latino representation on television.
I loved the show even before I was on it. I saw it at the Student Union of Carnegie Mellon University. I walked in, and there was a very bald, very young James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet. I said, what is this? I thought it was a show that taught lip reading, because, you know, he's very deliberate, A, B, C, as he is. Yes. The letters flashed over his head. I said, what the heck is this? But I saw Susan and Gordon, this beautiful African-American couple, I was stunned because at that time you did not see people of color on television. And if you did, they weren't the beautiful Susan and Gordon. And they certainly weren't any Latinos. And I was born and raised in the Bronx, watching a lot of television and wondering how could I contribute to a society that didn't see me. You know, I didn't see people like me. People would say, do you want to be a teacher when you grow up? I don't know. I never saw a Puerto Rican teacher. If you can't see it, you can't be it. And that moment of seeing Susan and Gordon gave me a little inspiration.
Did you know that the show would be as groundbreaking as it went on to be?
No one could have possibly known. It was a perfect storm. I always think of the Beatles. You know, the Beatles separately are great musicians, but they're not who they became as a group. And we had Jim Henson, Puppets, the Muppeteer, Joe Raposo, a brilliant composer who was able to write real music for children, John Stone, who was a visionary as far as television goes. And this was a great crash of creativity and civil involvement.
Compared to your time on Sesame Street and that what that show provides, how does your new show, Alma's Way, how does it address the learning needs of children today?
The good people at PBS Kids asked me to create a show, a Latin family show, so of course I made it. My old neighborhood in the South Bronx is where Alma and her family lives. And I took cues from Sesame Street. Sesame Street looked around society and said, kids need this. And that's what we provided. So I looked around today, and I said, what do kids need today? And I saw overcrowded classrooms, kids who didn't speak English, a lot of testing, and a lot of kids who, if they couldn't pass tests or couldn't memorize information, thought they weren't smart. So the idea of Alma's Way is to make sure kids know everybody has a brain. Everybody can put two and two together. That's just a given. So that these children who might be underserved or in stressful situations don't think that just because they can't pass a test or memorize information at the same moment that the next kid does, that's where we're heading. We want everybody to learn everything at the same time. That has nothing to do with your intellectual powers.
Have you noticed a shift in children's educational programming and how kids are taught today?
People ask me this all the time. Kids haven't changed, but what we expect of them has changed. We expect them on the internet because of COVID. The classes were held on television, so we expect that of them. We expect them to learn at the same moment as their peers, as I mentioned before, not at their own pace. They are still as curious as they ever were.
Seems like in some ways you kind of did become a teacher.
I guess I just observe what's going on around me and I'm very curious. This place, this Nia Family Center, I was waiting in the door and a kid comes in and says, blueberry muffins. I mean, she was ready to identify the objects around her. She must have been around three.
You've written a number of children's books throughout your career. What inspired you to write your memoir, Becoming Maria?
Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Well, I guess you get to a certain age where you want to really make sense of your journey. And the only way to make sense of it, I thought, was to take it outside of myself and write it down. I had to see family members I hadn't seen in many years in order to come to understand how we all impacted each other's lives.
In your book, you also talk about feeling invisible, even in your own house, and the struggles that happened while you were growing up. But the moment you learned to read, that's when it changed how you saw yourself.
Yes. I was raised in a household that was ruled by domestic violence, so that took precedent over everything. It was always, that was ruling the house. We were reading Dick and Jane books at school, and I was always ahead, and the teacher would not let me turn the page. I didn't know why we read these books. And then one day I was on the Third Avenue L. That's why I love the trains here in Chicago. And I was looking at the ads, and I asked my sister, what did they say? And she went, ugh, why don't you try reading it? And I thought, reading? I thought reading was something you only did in school with Dick and Jane books. Well, I saw the ads, and all of a sudden, the words just fell into place, And I sounded the words out, and it was like the world opened to me. And I said, it's not, you can read anywhere, you read signs. And that was an exciting moment to me. And it showed me, you don't have to take a kid the whole way. Just point them in a certain direction. Just say, try reading it. And, you know, I took it the rest of the way.
What's next for Sonia Manzano?
I want to work on another book. It certainly is disconcerting that there's an erasure of history, a desire to do that in this country. So I feel I want to write more Puerto Rican stories so that we are not forgotten.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And you can find more details about Sonia Manzano and her projects on our website. Up next, the history of a Chicago classic, but first, a look at the weather. Chicago is the steppin capital of the world. That's if you ask the godfather of steppin himself, DJ Sam Chapman, who's credited with coining the term. And though the dance craze's popularity has spread across the country, no one can do it quite like the hometown originators. We recently explored the local culture and history of steppin. Here's another look.
I started on the west side, Barber's Peppermint Lounge, MGM Grand. From there, it just exploded.
Before steppin' became steppin', it was known as bopping. But DJ Sam Chapman coined the phrase in the 1960s after admiring a friend's moves on the dance floor.
Draper would be dancing with a lady and he'd be, and I would say, step on Draper, step on Draper. And the word stepping, next thing I knew, I was putting it on a flyer.
Its popularity expanded, and other fellow Westsiders became inspired to host parties to resist the disco era.
We had nowhere to go. So I had this idea that, hey, I'm going to keep our music alive.
A woman fondly known as Black Mary Harris hosted steppin' events for more than 60 years. At 17 years old, she says she became a residential sweetheart for a social club. And the environment inspired her to host her own parties.
We almost got shut down because we had so many people up there.
Before graduating to big venues and clubs across the South Side, Harris and her crew used whatever location was available.
Anybody that had a basement that we could use, we would pay them a certain amount of money and fill out those index cards, pass them out, and had a DJ, and we just danced all night. It took me almost 4 years to get one party off the ground, and look what that party has turned into. We're all over the world now.
Harris says hosting a steppers event doesn't require much, but a few essentials.
The music had to be off the chain, and the venue had to be bathrooms, good parking, and a good dance floor. Back in the day when we learned to dance, it was always, if the man could do it, I could do it. So you're not going to outdo me. Because if you do it, baby, I'm coming back with it.
Steppin' requires a certain skill set.
They work on, they practice these moves over and over, and they get them down, they perfect them.
If he did something and I did something, or we did it together, it was the blendingness, it was the footwork, it was the mannerism of how you move your body.
And though other cities have adopted steppin', Chicagoans can always claim the original set.
We are the steppers' capital of the world.
Nobody can do it like Chicago, because first of all, Detroit, Atlanta, but Chicago, we do it 7 days a week, every day, and all of them will be packed.
And in addition to their moves, steppers always have to bring their looks.
You go to a steppers event, everybody is sharp. The colors, the outfits, your shoes had to be right, you know. Because, you know, everybody watching your feet.
And what's more, steppin' provided people with a space to let loose and relieve their worries.
I would tell them when I first started my party, leave all that mess outside. You come in here, free spirit, Have a good time. Pick it up when you leave my party.
And even as new dances emerge, Chatman remained confident that Stepin will never leave the dance floor.
Where did I see Stepin going? And I said, we haven't even scratched the surface, because I'm noticing parents and grandparents are teaching their children, their babies, to step.
Got to teach them young. And though it originated on the West Side, Stepin is just as popular on the city's South Side and, of course, throughout Chicago. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for The Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
No sense, no sense. There is no sense in the boy.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.